An Osho Talk. The White Lotus. Talks on the Zen Master Bodhidharma. Number 6.
The first question. What is innocence? Does being innocent require one to live a simple life? You become attuned with the ultimate love things. You stop fighting. You start flowing with it. The cunning mind fights, because it is through fight the ego arises. And the cunning mind can exist only around the ego. They can only be together. They are inseparable. If the ego disappears, the cunning mind disappears. And what is left is innocence. If you are fighting with life, if you are going against the current, if you are not natural, spontaneous, if you are living out of the past and not in the present, you are not innocent. To live according to the past is to live an irresponsible life. It is the life of reaction. You don't see what is the situation. You simply go on repeating your old solutions, and problems are every day new, every moment. Life goes on changing, and mind remains static. That is the whole problem, that the mind remains a static mechanism and life is a constant flux. Hence, there can be no communion between life and mind. If you remain identified with the mind, you will remain almost dead. You will not have any share of the joy that overwhelms existence. You will not be a participant in the celebration that is continuously going on. The birds singing, the trees dancing, the rivers flowing. You have also to be a part of this whole. You want to be separate. You want to prove yourself higher than others, superior than others. Then you become cunning. It is only through cunningness that you can prove your superiority. It is a dream. It is phony. Because in existence there is nobody who is superior and nobody who is inferior. The grass blades and the great star are absolutely equal. Existence is fundamentally communist. There is no hierarchy. But man wants to be higher than others. Wants to conquer nature. Hence, has to fight continuously. all complexity arises out of this fight. The innocent person is one who has renounced fighting, who is no more interested in being higher, who is no more interested in performing, in proving himself that he is something special, who has become like a rose flower or like a dewdrop on the lotus leaf, who has become part of this infinity, who has melted, merged, become one with the ocean, is just a wave, has no idea of the I. The disappearance of the I is innocence. Hence, innocence cannot require that you should live a simple life. Innocence cannot require anything of you. All requirements are cunning. All requirements are basically to fight, to be somebody. The so-called simple saint is not simple because he is fighting. Fighting with his instincts, fighting with his body. He is continuously at war, never at peace. How he can be simple? He is more complex than the ordinary people are. His complexity is, of course, very subtle and invisible. He cannot even sleep peacefully. Mahatma Gandhi was very much afraid of sleep. For the simple reason that while he was awake, he was able to repress his sexual desire. He believed in celibacy. He believed that celibacy is a basic requirement for a simple life, innocent life. While awake, he was able to compress, to repress, to control, to be the master of the instinct. But in his sleep, all control disappears. The mind goes to his sleep. The controlling, the fighting mind is no more in power. And the repressed starts surfacing. Hence sexual dreams. He was suffering from sexual dreams even when he was 70. And he was afraid of his sleep. And saints have always been afraid of his sleep. What kind of saints are these people? Sleep should be one of the most innocent things in life. And they are afraid of it. The fear is coming because of a certain requirement that they have imposed upon themselves, which they cannot fulfill in sleep. In sleep, the sex will surface. You may start dreaming things that you don't want. But now, you cannot have control over things. It is because of this fact that psychoanalysis is more interested in your dreams than in your waking life. It is strange. It is ironical. But it is very indicative. Indicative of the man and his repressions. You can't trust a man while he is in the so-called awake state. You cannot trust him. He is bound to falsify things. He is bound to be phony. And it may not be that he is deliberately phony. He may have become so accustomed with his phoniness that that's all that he knows about himself. He may have repressed his natural instincts so deeply, buried them so deep underground, that he himself has become absolutely unaware of their presence. You cannot trust what he says about himself when he is awake. You can trust only his dreams. Hence, psychoanalysis has to go into your dreams, because your dreams show your reality more clearly than what you say when you are awake. What kind of awakening is this? Your dreams are far more natural, far more authentic than your waking life. Mahatma Gandhi suffered to the very end from sexual dreams. He was very much afraid of his sleep, as all the saints have always been. They always go on cutting their sleep hours. And people think if the saint sleeps only 2 hours, he is such a great saint. He sleeps only 2 hours. And the reason why he sleeps 2 hours is fear. Fear of his own unconscious. It is not simple life. It is very complex. He goes on starving himself in the name of fasting. As if starving your body is any way going to help you to come closer to God. As if God is a sadist, and he wants you to be tortured. Do you think God is an Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, Genghis Khan, Tamerlan, Nadir Shah? What do you think about God? No father will like his children to be starved. But all religions, the so-called religions, Christianity, Hinduism, Jainism, Mohammedanism, all preach fasting. Because fasting gives you great ego. These two are basic instincts, food and sex. Food is needed for your survival. And sex is needed for the survival of the race. Both are basically needed for survival. If everybody fasts and everybody becomes a celibate, there is no need for atom bombs. There will be no Third World War. People will die on their own accord. Sex and food are deeply joined. Food keeps the individual alive, and sex keeps the race alive. That is their similarity. Sex is food for the race, and food is sex for the individual. Hence, one point more to be remembered. If you repress sex, you will start eating more food. Because you will have to compensate. If you stop eating enough food that is necessary for the body, you will become more and more sexual. You will have to compensate. And your sins are against both. Your sins are suicidal. Of course, their suicide is a very, very slow suicide. They are not even courageous to commit it in a single blow. They go on cutting themselves limb by limb. They go on destroying themselves slowly. They enjoy the whole process. They are messages. They torture themselves and they feel that by torturing themselves, they are purifying themselves and they are becoming holier. They are simply becoming pious egoists. And the pious egoist is far more dangerous than the ordinary egoist, because the ordinary egoist has a very grass ego. He knows he has it. Everybody else knows he has it. The politician lives with the grass ego. And the saint, the Mahatma, lives with a very subtle ego. And with such a facade of holiness that others will not be able to see it. He is so humble. He is so surrendered to God. And he lives such a simple life. Little food. Clothes are there. Are saints who don't use clothes as all. Jaina saints, they live naked. Their requirements are almost none. Living a naked life in a cave, in a primitive way, they seem to be very non-possessive. But that is only appearance. Deep down, they are hankering for heaven. Deep down, they are greedy. Deep down, they are thinking, nobody is more humble, more pious than they are. Deep down, they think about you as sinners and themselves as saints. This is a very complex situation. This is a fight with themselves. They have divided themselves into two, the higher and the lower. Even in the body they have a division, the higher part and the lower part. Above the sexual organs, the body is higher. Below the sexual organs, it is lower. As if body is divided anywhere. These stupid people should know that body is one. The blood circulates continuously from the feet to the head, from the head to the feet. It knows no division. Life pulsates all over the body. The body is an orgasm, an organic unity, a deep ecstasy. But if you divide it, you disturb its orgasmic quality. If you divide it, you become schizophrenic. And they divide the body, they divide the mind, the good mind, the bad mind, the sinner's mind, the saint's mind. And this way they go on becoming more and more schizophrenic. This is not simplicity. This is pathology. And they live in misery. They will never know anything of joy. They will not know anything of laughter. They have condemned laughter as a sin. That's why Christians say Jesus never laughed. They can't believe Jesus laughing. That looks so profane, almost sacrilegious. Ask the Jainas. They don't say anything in their scriptures. But they will also agree with Christians that Mahavira also never laughed. How these ideas can create simple human beings, those who cannot laugh, those who cannot dance, those who cannot sing, those who cannot enjoy the very ordinariness of life. I don't think that Christians or Jainas are right. I know Jesus, he laughed. I know him not through the scriptures. I know Mahavira. If he cannot laugh, then who will laugh? I know them from my innermost being. But the people who have imposed on them the idea of no laughter, of no joy, are the people who have been driving whole humanity crazy, mad, insane. They have converted the whole earth in a mad asylum. You ask me, what is innocence? Does being innocent require one to live a simple life? Innocence requires nothing. If it requires, it becomes complex. Innocence simply lives without any idea of how to live. Bring the how and you become complex. Innocence is a simple response to the present. Ideas are accumulated past. How Buddha lived, live like that and you will be a Buddhist. How Jesus lived, live like that and you will be a Christian. But you will be imposing something upon yourself. God never creates two persons alike. Each individual is unique. So if you impose Jesus upon yourself, you will be phony. All Christians are bound to be phony. All Hindus, all Jainas, all Buddhists. Because they are trying to be somebody they cannot be. You can't be Gautam Buddha. You can be a Buddha, but not Gautam Buddha. Buddha means awakened. That is your birthright. But Gautam is an individual. You can be a Christ, but not Jesus Christ. Jesus is an individual. Christ is another name for Buddhahood. It is the ultimate state of consciousness. Yes, that is possible. That is your potential. You can bloom and flower into a Christ consciousness, but you can never be Jesus. That is not possible. And it is good that it is not possible. But that's how so-called religious people have lived. Trying to follow somebody else, imitating. Now an imitator cannot be simple. He has constantly to adjust life to his ideas. A really innocent person goes with life. He simply flows with life. He has no goal as such. If you have a goal, you can't be innocent. You will have to be clever, cunning, manipulating. You will have to plan. And you will have to follow certain maps. How can you be innocent? You will be carrying so much rubbish from others. You will be just a carbon copy of Jesus, Buddha or Mahavira. you will not be the original. Bodhidharma says again and again, find your original face. And the only way to find your original face is to drop all imitation. Who is going to decide what is the requirement? Nobody can decide. And any decision is bound to disturb, because life may not turn the way you expect it to turn. It really never turns the way it is expected. Life is a constant surprise. You cannot prepare beforehand. Life needs no rehearsal. You have to be spontaneous. That is innocence. Now, if you are spontaneous, you cannot be Christian, and you cannot be Hindu, and you cannot be Buddhist. You have to be a simple human being. Simplicity is not a requirement, but a byproduct of innocence. It comes just like your shadow. You don't try to be simple. If you try to be simple, the very effort destroys simplicity. You cannot cultivate simplicity. A cultivated simplicity is superficial. Simplicity has to follow you like the shadow. You need not bother about it. You need not look again and again back whether the shadow is following you or not. The shadow is bound to follow you. Attain to innocence. Simplicity comes as a gift from God. And innocence means becoming a no mind, a no ego. Dropping all ideas of goals, achievements, ambitions, and living just as it happens in the moment. So I don't tell you to be celibate. Yes, one day celibacy can happen. But it will not be something to be practiced. It will be something that you will see happening. Yes, certainly, before one becomes a Buddha, one becomes celibate. But that is not a requirement, remember. Remember again and again. It is not a requirement that you have to fulfill. Then you will become a Buddha. No. If you simply go on becoming more aware of your mind, as the mind starts disappearing, becomes distant and distant from you, and you become unidentified with the mind, and you start seeing that you are separate, that you are not the mind, you will find many things happening with this disappearance of the mind. You will start living moment to moment, because it is mind that collects the past. You cannot depend on it. Your eyes will be clear, not covered with the dust of the past. You will be free from the dead past. And one who is free from the dead past is free to live authentically, sincerely, passionately, intensely. One can become aflame with life and its celibacy. But the mind is continuously distorting, continuously interfering, continuously telling you, do this, do that. It is like a schoolmaster. A meditator becomes free of the mind. And once the past is no more dominating you, future simply disappears. Because future is nothing but a projection of the past. In the past you have experienced certain pleasures and you would like to repeat them again and again. That is your projection for the future. In the past you have been through many miseries. Now you project in the future that you don't want those miseries again. Your future is nothing but a modified form of the past. Once past is gone, future is gone. Then what is left? This moment. Now. To live in the now and in the here is innocence. You cannot follow religious commandments if you really want to be innocent. A man who has constantly to think what to do and what not to do. A man who has constantly worried about what is right and what is wrong, cannot live innocently. Even if he goes on doing the right according to his conditioning, it is not right. He is simply following others. How it can be right? It may have been right for them. What was right for one person 2000 years before can't be right for you today. So much water has gone down the Ganges. Life is never the same for even 2 consecutive seconds. Heraclitus is right. You cannot step twice in the same river. And I say to you, you cannot step even once in the same river. The river is so fast flowing. An innocent person lives not according to certain requirements imposed by the society, church, state, parents, education. The innocent person lives out of his own being. Responsively, he responds to the situation that is confronting him. He takes the challenge. He accepts the challenge and does whatsoever in this moment his being wants to do, not according to certain principles. The innocent man has no principles, no ideology. The innocent man is absolutely unprincipled. The innocent man has no character. He is absolutely characterless. Because to have character means to have past. To have character means to be dominated by others. To have character means mind is still the dictator and you are just a slave. To be characterless, to be unprincipled, and to live in the moment, just as the mirror reflects whatsoever is in front of the mirror, your consciousness reflects and you act out of that reflection. That is awareness, that is meditativeness, that is samadhi, that is innocence. That is godliness. That is Buddhahood. There is no requirement in innocence. Not even the requirement to live a simple life. You can live a simple life. You can force a simple life upon yourself. It will not be simple. And you can live in a palace, in all the luxuries, but if you live in the moment, you are living a simple life. You can live like a beggar and you will not be simple. If effort to be a beggar is something that you have imposed upon yourself, if it has become your character, then you are not simple. Yes, once in a while it has happened that even a king lived a simple life. Simple life, not in the sense that he had not the palace and the possessions. They were there, but he was not possessive. This has to be understood. You may not have any possessions, yet you may be possessive. Possessiveness can exist without possessions. If that is so, then the vice versa is also true. Non-possessiveness can exist with all kinds of possessions. One can live in the palace and yet be totally free of it. There is a Zen story. A king was very much impressed by the simple and innocent life of a Buddhist monk. Slowly, slowly, he accepted him as his master. He watched. He was a very calculative man. He inquired about his character. Is there any loophole in his life? When he was totally convinced logically, his detectives informed him that this man has no dark spots in his life. He is absolutely pure, simple. He is really a great saint. He is a Buddha. Then he reached to the man, touched his feet and said, "Sir, I invite you to come to my palace and live there. Why live here?" Deep down, although he was inviting the saint, he was expecting that the saint will reject, that he will say, "No, I am a simple man. How I can live in the palace?" Although he was inviting him, you see the complexity of human mind. He was inviting him. He was hoping that if the invitation is accepted, he will be greatly joyous. And still there was an undercurrent that the saint, if he is truly a saint, will reject. He will say, "No, I am a simple man. I will live under the tree. This is my simple life. I have left all the world. I have renounced the world. I cannot come back to it." But the saint was really a saint. He must have been a Buddha. He said, "Okay. So where is the vehicle? Bring your chariot and I will come to the palace." He said, "Of course, when one comes to the palace, one has to come in style. Bring the chariot." The king was very much shocked. This man seems to be a cheat, a fraud. It seems that he was pretending all this simplicity just to catch hold of me. But now it is too late. He has invited and he cannot go against his own words. Being a man of words, a samurai, a warrior, a great king, he said, okay, now I am caught. This man is not worth anything. He did not even reject once. He should have rejected. He had to bring the chariot, but he was no more happy. He was not joyous. But the saint was very happy. He sat in the chariot like a king. And the king sat in the chariot very sad, looking a little silly. And people were watching on the streets. What is happening? The naked fakir. And he was really sitting like an emperor. And the king was looking very poor compared to this man. And he was so joyous, so bouncing with ecstasy. And the more he was ecstatic, the more the king was becoming sad. That now how to get rid of this man? I have caught in his net on my own. All those detectives and spies are fools. They could not see that this man has a plan. As if he was sitting under that tree for years, so that the king becomes impressed. All these ideas came into the head of the king. The king has arranged the best room for the saint. If he was to come. But he was not believing that he will ever come. You see the split of the human mind. You go on doing one thing, you go on expecting something else. If the man was cunning, he would have simply denied, he would have said no. If you take money to Vinoba Bhave, he closes his eyes. And deep down in you see, now this is a saint. You bring the money to me. And I will take the money and I will not thank you even. Then you will be very much soft. That what kind of man is this? I was moving in the Impala. And people started writing to me that you should not move in the Impala. I said, that is true. So I told Lakshmi, find out something else, something better. Because Impala is in America just the plumber's car. So Lakshmi has brought a Buick. Now people are saying, are you going to move in the Buick? I told Lakshmi, this won't do. Find out something better. Because Buick is the pimp's car in America. So now Lakshmi is bringing a Cadillac. The king had arranged the best room. The saint reached the room. He was sitting under the tree for years. And he said, bring this, bring that. If you have to live in the palace, you have to live like a king. The king was getting more and more puzzled. Of course, he has invited him, so whatsoever he asked was brought. But it was heavy on the heart of the king. It was becoming every day heavier, because the saint started living like the king. In fact, better than the king, because the king has his own worries and the saint has none. He will sleep in the day, in the night. He will enjoy the garden and the swimming pool. And he will rest and rest. And the king thought, this is a parasite. One day, it was unbearable. He said to the saint, the saint was for a morning walk in the garden, and the king also came, and he said, I wanted to say something to you. The saint said, yes, I know. You wanted to say it even before I had left my tree. You wanted to say it when I accepted your invitation. Why you waited so long? You are unnecessarily suffering, I can see. You have become sad. You don't come to me anymore. You don't ask great metaphysical religious questions as you used to ask me when I used to live under the tree. I know. But why you wasted 6 months, that I can't see. You should have asked immediately, and things would have settled then and there. I know what you want to ask, but ask. The king said, I want to ask only one thing. Now, what is the difference between me and you? You are living more luxuriously than I am living. And I have to work, and I have to worry, and I have to carry all kinds of responsibilities. And you have no work, no worry, no responsibility. I am feeling jealous of you. And I had certainly stopped coming to you, because I don't think there is any difference between me and you. I live in possessions, you live in more possessions than I. Every day you inquire, bring the golden chariot. I want to go for a walk in the country. Bring this and bring that, and you are eating delicious food. And you stopped being naked. Now you are using the best clothes possible. Then what is the difference between me and you? The saint laughed. And he said, the question is such, I can answer it only if you come with me. Let us go outside the capital. The king followed. They crossed the river and they continued. The king asked again and again, now what is the point of going on further? Why not answer now? The saint said, wait a little. I am in search of the right spot where to answer. Then they came to the very boundary of his kingdom, and the king said, now it is time. This is the very boundary. The saint said, that's what I have been searching for. Now, I am not going back. Are you coming with me? Or are you going back? The king said, how can I come with you? I have my kingdom, my possessions, my wives, my children. How can I come with you? And the saint said, now you see the difference, but I am going. And I will not look even once backwards. I was in the palace. I lived in all kinds of possessions, but I was not possessive. You are possessive. That is the difference. I am going. He undressed became naked, gave the dress to the king, that keep your clothes with you and be happy again. Now the king realized that he has been foolish. This man is rare, a rare gem. He fell unto his feet and he said, "Don't go. Come back. I have not understood you yet. Today, I have seen the difference." Yes, that is true sainthood. The saint said, "I can come back, but remember, you will become sad again. For me, there is no difference whether to go this side or that side. But you will become again sad. Now let me make you happy. I am not coming. I am going." The more the saint insisted to go, the more the king insisted for him to come back. But the saint said, "Once is enough. I have seen you are a stupid person. I can come. But the moment I say I can come, I can see in your eyes the old ideas coming back. Maybe he is again cheating. Maybe this is just empty gesture giving me the clothes and saying that I am going. So I become again impressed. If I come, you will be again miserable. And I don't want to make you miserable. Remember the difference. The difference is not in possessions. The difference is in possessiveness. A simple person is not one who possesses nothing. A simple person is one who has no possessiveness, who never looks back. This simplicity cannot be practiced. This simplicity can come only as a consequence of innocence. Otherwise, you will practice on one hand, and from some other corner of your being, and you are a vast continent. You are not like an island. You are really a vast continent. And in the deepest core of your being, there is still uncharted territory, unmapped territory. You still carry a great dark continent like Africa inside you, which you have never travelled, of which you are not even aware, of its presence you are unaware. If you repress, and that's what cultivation is, then it will start coming into another form from somewhere else. You will become more and more complex in this way, more and more cunning and calculative in this way, more disciplined, more with character which people respect and honor. If you want to enjoy your ego, the best way is to be a holy man. But if you really want to celebrate existence, the best way is to be absolutely ordinary, utterly ordinary, and live the ordinary life with no pretensions. Live moment to moment. That is innocence. And innocence is enough. Don't try to become simple. Millions of people have tried and they have not become simple at all. On the contrary, they have become very, very complex, entangled into their own jungle, into their own ideas. Get out of the mind. That is innocence. Be a no mind. That is innocence. And everything else follows. And when everything else follows, it has a beauty of its own. Cultivated, it is plastic, synthetic, not natural. Uncultivated, when it comes, it is a grace, it is a benediction. The second question, sometimes it feels as if physical death would be the only shock powerful enough to wake me up, and I find myself wishing for it, as perhaps an escape from or an end to this grey slumber that surrounds me. What can break this dream when the dreamer is so sleepy? If you really want to commit suicide, follow the wise Irishman I have heard about. An Irishman wanted to commit suicide. He bought a bottle of aspirin, took two, and felt better. Death cannot wake you up, because Pritima, you have died many times before and it has not awakened you yet. You are not new here. Nobody is new. All are ancient pilgrims, very ancient. You have seen Buddhas, Christs, Zarathustras, Lao Tzus. You have seen the whole evolution of human consciousness. You have been part of it. You have been here many times, and death has happened again and again. It has not helped in any way. It can't help. Because death has a natural mechanism. Before you die, you become unconscious. Death as if uses anesthesia. So is birth. Birth also happens in unconsciousness. Just think, one thing is certain, that you have been born. You may not be so certain about your past lives. Maybe it is just a theory. But one thing is absolutely certain, that you were born one day. At least this life is there. Do you remember anything of the birth? And birth and death are not separate. Two aspects of the same coin. On one side is birth, on another side it is death. On one side it is death, another side it is birth. It is the same coin. Heads or tails, it makes no difference. It is the same coin. You see one person dying. Here he is dying. Somewhere else he has started being born. The moment he is dead here, he would have entered another womb somewhere. It takes seconds, only seconds, to enter another womb. Millions of foolish people are always making love, 24 hours. You will not have to search long. You will not have to search and wait. You will not have even to stand in a queue, remember. That's why it happens again and again that if a person dies in India, he is born again in India. More or less it happens that way. Because who cares to go far away? Just in the neighborhood, some foolish couple is ready to receive you. The birth has been there, but you were unconscious. Birth also happens in unconsciousness because that too is very painful process. It is a kind of death. You lived in the womb for 9 months. It was your life for 9 months. And the 9 months in the womb are not 9 months for the child. For the child it is almost eternity because he has no sense of time. And then suddenly one day, the womb is ready to expel you. To the child, it looks like death. He is dying. His world is disappearing. His way of life, of which he has become accustomed, is being taken away from him. All that he knows about life is going to be destroyed. Without the womb, he cannot conceive what life can there be. The womb is all that he knows. Beyond the womb is all unknown. Death is painful, so is birth. Hence there is a natural mechanism. The child bonds in an unconscious state. And the old man dies in an unconscious state. Doctors, surgeons have started using anesthetic processes only recently, chloroform, etc. But death and birth have been using them since eternity. When you die, before the exact moment of death, you become unconscious. Because it is going to be very painful. Just think, your consciousness which has become so attached to the body for 70, 80 or 90 years. You have become so identified with the body, you will cling. You will do everything that you can do to remain in the body. Now again you are being thrown out of the body. And so many desires are unfulfilled. And so many ambitions are still hovering around you. So many desires and dreams. And everything is shattering. And your body is being taken away from you. Not only the body, but your brain too. And that's what you have become identified with. You need a great anesthesia. The body has its own ways to release anesthesia in you. Sooner or later, medical science is going to discover it. They have not yet discovered it. But sooner or later, they will find it, that the body has chemical processes which are released at the time of death and the person becomes unconscious. Just as in anger, certain chemicals are released in your blood and you become mad. A momentary kind of madness. Your own glands do it. When you become sexually possessed, it is your glands releasing certain secretions and you are not conscious. You become almost unconscious. Death is one of the most painful processes. So, Pritima, you can die, but you will die unconsciously. Death will not wake you up. It will make you more unconscious. The only way to be awakened is to be in communion with someone who is already awakened. The only way, there is no other, is to be in the company of the awakened one, is to be in the commune of the awakened one. And Pritima, you are fortunate. You are in the company of the awakened one and in the communion of those who are seeking awakening. You are in a Buddha field. If this cannot wake you up, nothing else can do it. But don't be so much worried about it. That worry is unnecessary. Leave it to me. Leave all your grey slumber, all your dreams to me. I don't ask for anything from you. At least give me your dreams. Give me your worries. Give me your sleep. Rather than worrying about how to wake up, start watching your dreams. A little bit of alertness will start arising in you. Instead of being worried, start watching your worries. And watching the worries will help you to come out of the worries. There are only two things to worry about. Either you are sick or you are well. If you are well, there is nothing to worry about. But if you are sick, there are only two things to worry about. Either you get better or you die. If you get better, there is nothing to worry about. But if you die, there are only two things to worry about. Either you go to heaven or you go to hell. If you go to heaven, there is nothing to worry about. But if you go to hell, you will be so darn busy shaking hands with your friends, you won't have time to worry. So why worry? Start rather enjoying. Enjoy your sleep. That will help you to wake up faster. Enjoy your dreams. Because if you can enjoy your dreams, enjoy your sleep, you have already become a little distant. When you are worried, you become more involved. When you are enjoying, you can be a watcher. And don't be in a hurry either. Nothing happens before its right time. There is a season for everything to happen. So just wait for the spring. Meanwhile, enjoy whatsoever is there. Clouds are there, dark clouds, enjoy them. They have their own beauty. Once in a while, the sun breaks through, enjoy it. Sometimes it is raining, enjoy it. Enjoy all the moods of life. That's how one becomes mature, ripe. This life is an opportunity to become seasoned. Don't avoid anything. Grey slumber has also something to contribute to your growth. And your dreams are also to become steps, stepping steps towards awakening. But everybody seems to be in such a hurry that nobody wants to wait for the spring. But spring comes when it comes. Your hurrying will simply create chaos in you. Your impatience will create mess of you. Be patient. And whatsoever the situation, accept it. And enjoy it. Yes, there is a silver line to every dark cloud. But people are so impatient, so pessimistic, that I have heard they have changed the old proverb. The old proverb is, every dark cloud has a silver lining. They have changed it. Now they say, every silver lining has a dark cloud. It all depends how you look at things. Be a little more optimistic. Be a little more rejoicing. Yes, even if you sing in your dream, even if you dance in your dream, it is helpful. Because your singing and your dancing may wake you up. But if you worry and you think of society, and you think of getting rid of this life because you are not waking up soon as you would like, is a very pessimistic attitude. It is not life enhancing. It is destructive. Beware of such destructive tendencies. Death is not going to hell. I am here to hammer, to shatter you. Just give me a little chance. Things are moving beautifully. Many are coming closer and closer to maturity. But unless you come to the 100-degree point, you can't evaporate. Even at 99 degrees, you are still water, hot water. And the heat becomes more and more painful. Before it reaches to the 100-degree, and you simply evaporate. And then the last change, then you enter into a different field. Water flows downwards and vapor floats upwards. Water is visible, vapor is invisible. Water seeks the lowest place on the earth, and the vapor seeks the highest. The vapor goes towards the peaks. But I cannot give you more heat than you can absorb at the moment. I have to be very, very careful, because too much heat may prove destructive. Too much heat may destroy something fragile in you. Too much heat, you may escape. Too much heat will make you so hot that you may start thinking life is unbearable. I have to give you heat in homeopathic doses. So slowly, slowly you become accustomed of it. Because I have to take you up to 100 degrees. But many are moving towards it. And whenever it will start happening, many are going to become awakened. Almost simultaneously. That's how it happened in Buddha's time. Just one person, Manjushri, became enlightened, his first disciple to become enlightened. And immediately a chain, Sariputra, Maudgalayana, Purnakashyap, and others immediately followed. As if Manjushri triggered the process. Maybe he was the first flower of the spring. And then the whole spring burst forth. That's how it is going to be here. Slowly, slowly, you are getting ready. The spring is coming closer. Wait. Wait and watch. The third question. When a master dies, suddenly a myth springs up around him. Man makes stone or wooden idols of him. The master becomes a distant god to be worshipped and becomes unattainable to ordinary men. The thought of the master being an example of what we should and can be disappears. Why does this phenomenon happen time and time again? It is something very natural to the unconscious state of humanity. The living master is a danger. But the dead master is no more a danger. The living master can wake you up. You cannot dodge him. He simply goes like an arrow into the heart. But a dead master is a dead master. He is just a memory. He is no more there. And now, the disciples start worshipping him. Why? It is out of a guilt feeling that they never heard him while he was alive. They feel guilty. They repent. Now they have to do something to get rid of guilt. Worshipping is out of guilt. you will be surprised to know. You may not have thought that worship is guilt standing upside down. The people crucified Jesus, and the same people started worshipping Him. It is repentance. They started feeling a great pain, a great heaviness, a great anxiety. They have done something wrong. They have to compensate for it. They have to worship this man. They condemned Him like a criminal. And they worshipped Him like God. The same has been happening again and again. Worship comes out of guilt. One thing. Second, worship is a way to avoid the Master. By worshipping, you start feeling that you are doing whatsoever you can do. What more there is? You need not change. Worship is enough. If the Master is alive and you only worship Him and you don't change, He is going to hit on your heads. The living Master, even if He allows you to worship Him, allows you to worship Him only so that you can come closer to Him. That's all. He allows you to worship Him so that you can come close and He can really destroy your ego. He wants you to become intimate with Him. If this is the only way you know, and this is the only way you know, because you have been always worshipping Buddha, Krishna, Jesus, Muhammad, you have been worshipping. So when you come to a living Master, the first thing that you can do is worship Him. He allows you to worship Him so that you can come closer, so that you can be caught into His net. But a dead Master is no more there to do anything to you. Now you can start doing things to the Master. You can take revenge. You can make a stone or wooden statue of the Master, and you can bow down to the statue that you have made. You are bowing down to yourself, to your own creation. It is like, and it will be far better, when you make a temple in your house, it is better to fix a big mirror and sit before the mirror and bow down to your own image. Because the Master that you create is the Master that you create in your own image. The Bible says God created man in His own image. Maybe in the beginning He did, but man has paid Him well. And in the same coin, man has made God in his own image. When you worship a Master, you start creating a Master of your own idea. Hence the myth springs. The myth comes from your unconscious. The Master is physically dead. Now you want Him to be spiritually dead too. The myth will do it. He will become spiritually dead too. Your myth is a lie. And the more the Master becomes surrounded by myth, fictions, the more and more unreal He becomes. That's why it is very difficult to believe that Jesus is a historical person. Very difficult to believe. It is because of the mythology that has been created around Him. He walks on water. He turns the ocean into wine. Out of few loaves, He makes millions of people eat. He turns stones into bread. The people who created these myths are really getting rid of the reality of the Master. Although He is dead, but a certain impact of the Master still continues that has to be effaced. The myth will do the work. Death has destroyed His body. Myth will destroy His spirituality. He will become just a mythological figure. Utterly impotent. Useless. The myth is a process in which you chain the Master's historic reality into a fiction. Jesus, as a historical person, may be embarrassing. Jesus as myth is beautiful, because myth is created by you according to your expectations. No living Master ever fulfills anybody's expectations. He lives His own life. Either you accept Him or you reject Him, makes no difference. You can kill Him, you can worship Him, it makes no difference. He goes on living in His own way. He goes on doing His own thing. He cannot be forced to fulfill your requirements of Him. People try in every possible way. They come to me, letters reach to me, that Bhagwan, if you do only one thing, millions of people will be benefited because they will start coming to you. Please stop talking about sex. India will worship you. People are ready to accept you, but you disturb them. Now, these people who are fast asleep are advising me, what should I say, what I should not say. In these 20 years, thousands of people have come to me. Very few have remained, because they all came with expectations. And I have not been fulfilling anybody's expectations. In fact, if I see somebody expecting, I immediately destroy it. I want people here only, without expectations from me. Otherwise, followers try to become masters of the masters. They start dictating them, do this, eat this, live like this. Because then more and more people will come. It is not a question that more and more are needed. Only those are needed who have no expectations. Because only those are capable of being awakened. But once the Master is gone, He cannot prevent you from creating myth. So whatsoever was hurting you, you will change. Whatsoever was offensive to you, you will drop. And you will replace it by something beautiful. That's what has been the root cause why myths spring. Jesus lived a very human life, utterly human, with great godliness, but He lived a human life. He is a rare master in that way. He moved with gamblers, drunkards. There is every possibility once in a while he may have played poker. And I don't see that there is anything wrong in it. He used to drink wine. He enjoyed it. And I don't think there is anything wrong in it. Once in a while, it is sheer playfulness. Don't become addicted to it. He was not addicted to it. But he participated in the ordinary life. There is every possibility that Mary Magdalene fell in a very human kind of love with him. And it cannot be only one-sided. He may have responded. But Christians will feel offended. A prostitute falling in love with Jesus. And Jesus may have responded in a human way. In fact, he was such a courageous man, such a rebel, that he must have responded in a human way. Rock Hudson dies and goes to heaven, knocks at the gate and requests permission to enter. St. Peter says, sure, all you need is 2 passport photographs and to fill in this form B31. Now, what is your name? Rock Hudson. Occupation? Film actor. Sorry, says St. Peter, no film actors allowed. Why? Asks Rock, amazed. St. Peter says, because you people are known to be great sinners. All this nudity in films, scandals, all kind of vices. Sorry, you can't come in. But I am a personal friend of Jesus, says Rock. Go and ask him. St. Peter goes to Jesus and says, there is a big guy at the gate. He says he is a friend of yours. His name is Rock Hudson. Rock Hudson, says Jesus, ah, my God, and I have not got a thing to wear. Jesus must have been a very human master. It is because of his great humanity that he is to suffer, that he is to be crucified. It is because of his great humanity. If he had lived just like a god, just a holy saint, chanting mantras, fasting, living in a cave, the same rabbis would have worshipped him. Before Jesus, they have not killed anybody else. Why Jesus? This is strange. The Jewish history has no precedent. What was his sin? What was his crime? His crime was that he was trying to live a very ordinary life. He wanted to show you that if you are living an ordinary life, yet you can be enlightened. You can move with prostitutes and gamblers and drunkards, and yet you can be absolutely holy. He wanted to show you this paradox. He wanted to become an example of it. That's why he is crucified. In India, Buddha is not crucified. Mahavira is not crucified.
Why? They never lived in any human way. They lived aloof, very aloof, cool, far away, distant. There was no need to crucify them. Hence my love for Jesus is immense. Buddha, you can respect, but you cannot love. Jesus, you can love too. And if you respect, you respect out of love. And the same has to be the situation here. I don't want your respect. If your respect comes as part of your love, it is welcome. Otherwise, I don't want your respect. I don't want to be respectable. It is better to be crucified by people than to be respectable. Respectable means you have bowed down to the sleepers, that you have surrendered your freedom. This is possible only if you fulfill their expectations, then they will respect you. They will call you holy. But if you live an ordinary life, just as people live, and you enjoy the ordinary things of life, of course with a difference, with a great difference, a difference that really makes difference, you bring God closer to the earth. You bring heaven closer to the earth. Then they are going to kill you while you are alive. And when you are gone, the same people will start changing your life, painting your life again and again. As the demands will change according to the changes in time and fashions, they will go on painting you. There are many Christs, really. If you go through these 2000 years, you will find many Christs, not one, because each age demands a different kind of holy man. So each age has to paint Jesus according to its expectations. That's how myths are created. Then another age has to impose its myths. And this goes on and on. And the whole life becomes fictitious. Now the whole thing is so fictitious. The virgin birth is an impossibility. But they have to impose that myth of virgin birth. Because ordinary people are born out of sexual intercourse. How Jesus can be born out of sexual intercourse? He is born without any sexuality. This is unbiological, unscientific. But such things the followers will do, just to make him look separate, different, supernatural. The Buddhists say when Buddha was born, his mother was standing. Buddhists say when Buddhas are born, the mothers are always standing. It's strange. Why Buddha cannot born while the mother is lying on her back? That is how everybody is born. Buddhas have to be born in a special way. And then what Buddha did? He comes out of the womb, is standing. He falls on the ground, is standing. And then he takes 7 steps. And he declares that I am the greatest of the greatest. That is the first thing he does. After 7 steps. Now such foolish things. Jainas say that their Tirthankaras are always born in the warrior caste, Kshatriyas. Mahavira enter in the womb of a Brahmin woman. But that is not according to the law. You see the expectations of people. Not only in life they will expect you, even before life, they will force their expectations. So they have created a story that gods were very much disturbed. This has never happened. A Tirthankara, a Jaina master, enlightened master, has to be born out of a Kshatriya woman, warrior caste woman. It was an antagonism against the Brahmins. And Mahavira entered into the womb of a Brahmin woman. So gods could not tolerate it. When he was 3 months old in the woman's womb, they removed him. They took him out. That seems to be the first surgery. They removed Mahavira from the Brahmin woman's womb, and they removed another child from the queen's womb, the queen's child, a girl, was put into the Brahmin's womb, and Mahavira was replaced. 2 things were wrong. First, the Tirthankara has to be a man. Secondly, he has to be born out of a Kshatriya woman. What expectations? What foolish kind of expectations? But these myths go on growing later on. These myths are for a certain reason. The disciples want, the followers want their master to be special. Special from ordinary people and special from other masters too. You ask me, when a master dies, suddenly a myth springs up around him. Man makes stone or wooden idols of him. The master becomes a distant god to be worshipped and becomes unattainable to ordinary men. That's precisely the purpose of worship. To make the man so distant and so far away that you can only worship. You need not practice whatsoever has been his teaching. You need not wake up from your sleep. Worshipping can continue in your sleep beautifully. It does not disturb sleep. In fact, it functions as a sedative, a tranquilizer. You ask me, the thought of the master being an example of what we should and can be disappears. That is precisely the purpose, that it should disappear. So there is no need for us to try, to endeavor for the peaks. Then we can live in our sleep peacefully. There is nobody to disturb. If Buddha is a human being, if Jesus is a human being, and they can become so enlightened, so full of light, so full of love, so full of bliss, then their idea will haunt you. It will not leave you alone. Continuously, it will be there inside you that you have to attain this state too. Otherwise, you are not fulfilling. Otherwise, you are not doing what is needed to be done. You are missing an opportunity. You ask me, why does this phenomenon happen time and time again? Because men's stupidity is the same. The last question. I am a scientist. Science teaches to observe detachedly. Is it not the same with religion? Sudharma. Science teaches a detached observation. Art teaches a non-detached observation. Religion simply teaches observation, neither detached nor detached. The scientist has to be there just a spectator, indifferent, cold. That's how he can come to know the secrets of the matter. The artist has to participate in nature. Without participation, he will not know the beauty of the flower, of the moon, of the sunset, of the clouds. He will have to become a participant. He will have to dissolve himself into their reality. The observer has to become the observed in the world of art. Only then he can be able to paint, to sculpt, to create music or poetry. A man came to a great painter and asked him, I want to paint bamboos. What should I do? The master said, first you go into the jungle and live with the bamboos for 3 years. When you start feeling that you have become a bamboo, come back. The man never returned. 3 years passed. The master waited and waited, and then he had to go in search of the man. What has happened? Because when you have become a bamboo, how can you come to the master back? When the master reached, he saw in a bamboo grove, the man was standing. The wind was blowing, the bamboos were swaying and dancing, and the man was swaying and dancing. The master shook him. He said, what are you doing? When you are going to paint? He said, forget all about it. Get lost. Don't disturb me. The master has to drag him back home. He said, now you are ready to paint the bamboo. Because now you know from the inside what a bamboo is. Science observes from the outside. Art enters into the inside of things. But religion is a transcendence. It is beyond science and beyond art. Science is objective, art is subjective, religion is neither. It is pure awareness, neither cold nor hot. That's why I call it cool. Science is cold, art is hot, religion is cool. But observation is needed all the same in all the three planes. It changes its quality. The lowest observation is detached observation. A little higher is art, participant observation. And the highest is just observation. But observation is the essential phenomenon. That is the thread that joins science, art and religion. This happened in the auditorium of a faculty of medicine. The well-known professor begins his first course with this declaration. To be a good practitioner, two qualities are required. The first is, you should not be disgusted with anything. The second is, you should be able to observe accurately. As an illustration of this, watch. You see this age-old corpse lying on the table? I dip one finger in the anus of the corpse. And then you see, I take it out, put it in my mouth and suck it. The whole class is horrified. The professor goes on, now, who of you will be able to do this? A very jealous student comes up and without hesitation dips his finger into the corpse anus and sucks it. A great silence follows this performance. The professor congratulates the student, very good, young man. You certainly have the first quality required to be a good doctor. That is not to be disgusted with anything. However, the second quality is missing. You have no sense of observation at all. You see, it was this finger, the index, that I dipped. And it was this finger, the medius, that I put into my mouth. Enough for today.